down at him from the walls. Most had spooky eyes that seemed to follow him as he walked, marking him as an intruder. He knew their eyes were only paint, but still. One in particular troubled him, a fat man with clouds of red hair, a bulldog mouth, and a mean glare in his eye, as if he wanted to ask what some half-wit inn-boy was doing in the great hall at Mayor's house.
"Quit looking at me that way, you big old son of a bitch!"
Sheenie whispered and felt a little better, for the moment at least. Next came the dining hall, also empty, with the long trestle tables pushed back against the wall. There was the remains of a meal on one, a single plate of cold chicken and sliced bread, half a mug of ale. Looking at those few bits of food on a table that had served dozens at various fairs and festivals, that should have served dozens this very day, brought the enormity of what had happened home to Sheenie. And the sadness of it, too. Things had changed in Hambry, and would likely never be the same again. These long thoughts did not keep him from gobbling the leftover chicken and bread, or from chasing it with what remained in the ale pot. It had been a long, foodless day. He belched, clapped both hands over his mouth, eyes making quick and guilty side-to-side darts above his dirty fingers, and then walked on. The door at the far end of the room was latched, but unlocked. Sheenie opened it and poked his head out into the corridor which ran the length of Mayor's house. The way was lit with gas chandeliers and was as broad as an avenue. It was empty, at least for the moment, but he could hear whispering voices from other rooms, and perhaps other floors as well. He supposed they belonged to the maids and any other servants that might be about this afternoon, but they sounded very ghostly to him just the same. Perhaps one belonged to Mayor Thorin, wandering the corridor right in front of him, if Sheenie could but see him, which he was glad he couldn't. Mayor Thorin wandering and wondering what had happened to him, what this cold, jelly-like stuff soaking into his nightshirt might be, who a hand gripped Sheenie's arm just above the elbow. He almost shrieked.
"Don't," a woman whispered, "for your father's sake."
Sheenie somehow managed to keep the scream in. He turned, and there, wearing jeans and a plain checked ranch shirt, her hair tied back, her pale face set, her dark eyes blazing, stood the mayor's widow.
"Thorin, I...
There was nothing else he could think of to say. Now she'll call for the guards of the watch if there be any left, he thought. In a way it would be a relief.
"Have you come for the girl? The Delgado girl?"
Grief had been good to Olive in a terrible way, had made her face seem less plump and oddly young. Her dark eyes never left his and forbade any attempt at a lie. Sheenie nodded.
"Good. I can use your help, boy. She's down below in the pantry and she's guarded."
Sheenie gaped, not believing what he was hearing.
"Do you think I believe she had anything to do with Hart's murder?"
Olive asked, as if Sheenie had objected to her idea.
"I may be fat and not so speedy on my pins any more, but I'm not a complete idiot. Come on now, Seafront's not a good place for Cy Delgado just now. Too many people from town know where she is."
5. Roland? He will hear this voice in uneasy dreams for the rest of his life, never quite remembering what he has dreamed, only knowing that the dreams leave him feeling ill somehow, walking restlessly, straightening pictures in loveless rooms, listening to the call to muezzin in alien town squares. Roland of Gilead. This voice, which he almost recognizes, a voice so like his own that a psychiatrist from Eddie's or Susanna's or Jake's when and where would say it is his voice, the voice of his subconscious. But Roland knows better. Roland knows that often the voices that sound the most like our own when they speak in our heads are those of the most terrible outsiders, the most dangerous intruders. Roland, son of Stephen. The ball has taken him first to Hambry and to Mayor's house, and he would see more of what is happening there, but then it takes him away, calls him away, in that strangely familiar voice, and he has to go. There is no choice, because unlike Rhea or Jonas, he is not watching the ball and the creatures who speak soundlessly within it. He is inside the ball, a part of its endless pink storm. Roland, come. Roland, see. And so the storm whirls him first up and then away. He flies across the drop, rising and rising through stacks of air, first warm and then cold, and he is not alone in the pink storm, which bears him west along the path of the beam. Sheb flies past him, his hat cocked back on his head. He is singing Hey Jude at the top of his lungs, as his nicotine-stained fingers plink keys that are not there. Transported by his tune, Sheb doesn't seem to realize that the storm has ripped his piano away. Roland, come, the voice says, the voice of the storm, the voice of the glass, and Roland comes. The romp flies by him, glassy eyes blazing with pink light. A scrawny man in farmer's overalls goes flying past, his long red hair streaming out behind him. Life for you and for your crop, he says, something like that anyway, and then he's gone. Next, spinning like a weird windmill, comes an iron chair. To Roland, it looks like a torture device equipped with wheels, and the boy gunslinger thinks the Lady of Shadows, without knowing why he thinks it or what it means. Now the pink storm is carrying him over blasted mountains, now over a fertile green delta, where a broad river runs its oxbow squiggles like a vein, reflecting a placid blue sky that turns to the pink of wild roses as the storm passes above. Ahead, Roland sees an uprushing column of darkness, and his heart quails, but this is where the pink storm is taking him, and this is where he must go. I want to get out, he thinks. But he's not stupid. He realizes the truth. He may never get out. The wizard's glass has swallowed him. He may remain in its stormy, muddled eye forever. I'll shoot my way out if I have to, he thinks, but no, he has no guns. He is naked in the storm, rushing bare-ass toward that virulent blue-black infection that has buried all the landscape beneath it. And yet he hears singing, faint but beautiful. A sweet, harmonic sound that makes him shiver and think of Susan, bird and bear and hare and fish. Suddenly, Shimi's mule, Capricoso, Roland thinks, a beautiful name, goes past, galloping on thin air, with his eyes as bright as fire dims in the storm's lumbre fuego. Following him, wearing a sombrero and riding a broom festooned with fluttering reap charms, comes Rhea of the Coos.
"I'll get you, my pretty," she screams at the fleeing mule, and then, cackling, she is gone, zooming and brooming.
Roland plunges into the black, and suddenly his breath is gone. The world around him is noxious darkness. The air seems to creep on his skin like a layer of bugs. He is buffeted, boxed to and fro by invisible fists, then driven downward in a dive so violent he fears he will be smashed against the ground. So fell Lord Perth. Dead fields and deserted villages roll up out of the gloom. He sees blasted trees that will give no shade. Oh, but all is shade here. All is death here. This is the edge of Endworld, where some dark day he will come, and all is death here. Gunslinger, this is Thunderclap. Thunderclap, he says. Here are the unbreathing, the white faces. The unbreathing, the white faces. Yes, he knows that somehow. This is the place of slaughtered soldiers, the cloven helm, the rusty halberd. From here come the pale warriors. This is Thunderclap, where clocks run backward and the graveyards vomit out their dead. Ahead is a tree like a crooked, clutching hand. On its topmost branch a billy bumbler has been impaled. It should be dead, but as the pink storm carries Roland past, it raises its head and looks at him with inexpressible pain and weariness.
"Oi!"
it cries, and then it too is gone, and not to be remembered for many years. Look ahead, Roland. See your destiny. Now suddenly he knows that voice. It is the voice of the turtle. He looks and sees a brilliant blue-gold glow piercing the dirty darkness of Thunderclap. Before he can do more than register it, he breaks out of the darkness and into the light like something coming out of an egg, a creature at last being born. Light! Let there be light! The voice of the turtle cries, and Roland has to put his hands to his eyes and peek through his fingers to keep from being blinded. Below him is a field of blood, or so he thinks then, a boy of 14 who has that day done his first real killing. This is the blood that has flowed out of Thunderclap and threatens to drown our side of the world, he thinks. And it will not be for untold years that he will finally rediscover his time inside the ball and put this memory together with Eddie's dream and tell his compadres as they sit in the turnpike breakdown lane at the end of the night that he was wrong, that he had been fooled by the brilliance coming as it did so hard on the heels of Thunderclap shadows. It wasn't blood but roses, he tells Eddie, Susanna, and Jake. Gunslinger, look. Look there. Yes, there it is, a dusty gray-black pillar rearing on the horizon. The Dark Tower, the place where all beams, all lines of force converge. In its spiraling windows he sees fitful electric blue fire and hears the cries of all those pent within. He senses both the strength of the place and the wrongness of it. He can feel how it is spooling error across everything, softening the divisions between the worlds, how its potential for mischief is growing stronger, even as disease weakens its truth and coherence, like a body afflicted with cancer. This jutting arm of dark gray stone is the world's great mystery and last awful riddle. It is the tower, the Dark Tower rearing to the sky. And as Roland rushes toward it in the pink storm, he thinks, I will enter you, me and my friends, if Ka wills it so. We will enter you, and we will conquer the wrongness within you. It may be years yet, but I swear by bird and bear and hare and fish, by all I love that— But now the sky fills with flaggy clouds, which flow out of Thunderclap, and the world begins to go dark. The blue light from the tower's rising windows shines like mad eyes, and Roland hears thousands of screaming, wailing voices. You will kill everything and everyone you love, says the voice of the turtle. And now it is a cruel voice, cruel and hard. And still the tower will be pent shut against you. The gunslinger draws in all his breath and draws together all his force. When he cries his answer to the turtle, he does so for all the generations of his blood. No, it will not stand. When I come here in my body, it will not stand. I swear on my father's name, it will not stand. Then die, the voice says, and Roland is hurled at the gray-black stone flank of the tower to be smashed there like a bug against a rock. But before that can happen... 6. Cuthbert and Alain stood watching Roland with increasing concern. He had the piece of Merlin's rainbow raised to his face, cupped in his hands as a man might cup a ceremonial goblet before making a toast. The drawstring bag lay crumpled on the dusty toes of his boots. His cheeks and forehead were washed in a pink glow that neither boy liked. It seemed alive somehow, and hungry. They thought, as if with one mind, I can't see his eyes. Where are his eyes? Roland? Cuthbert repeated. If we're going to get out to Hanging Rock before they're ready for us, you have to put that thing away. Roland made no move to lower the ball. He muttered something under his breath. Later, when Cuthbert and Alain had a chance to compare notes, they both agreed it had been Thunderclap. Roland? Alain asked, stepping forward. As gingerly as a surgeon slipping a scalpel into the body of a patient, he slipped his right hand between the curve of the ball and Roland's bent, studious face. There was no response. Alain pulled back and turned to Cuthbert. "Can you touch him?" Bert asked. Alain shook his head. "Not at all. It's like he's gone somewhere far away." "We have to wake him up." Cuthbert's voice was dust-dry and shaky at the edges. "Vanet told us that if you wake a person from a deep hypnotic trance too suddenly, he can go mad," Alain said. "Remember?" "I don't know if I dare," Roland stirred. The pink sockets where his eyes had been seemed to grow. His mouth flattened into the line of bitter determination they both knew well. "No, it will not stand," he cried, in a voice that made goose flesh ripple the skin of the other two boys. That was not Roland's voice at all, at least not as he was now. That was the voice of a man. "No," Alain said much later, when Roland slept and he and Cuthbert sat up before the campfire. That was the voice of a king. Now, however, the two of them only looked at their absent, roaring friend, paralyzed with fright. "When I come here in my body, it will not stand. I swear on my father's name, it will not stand." Then, as Roland's unnaturally pink face contorted, like the face of a man who confronts some unimaginable horror, Cuthbert and Alain lunged forward. It was no longer a question of perhaps destroying him in an effort to save him. If they didn't do something, the glass would kill him as they watched. In the dooryard of the barquet, it had been Cuthbert who clipped Roland. This time Alain did the honors, administering a hard right to the center of the gunslinger's forehead. Roland tumbled backward, the ball spilling out of his loosening hands and the terrible pink light leaving his face. Cuthbert caught the boy, and Alain caught the ball. Its heavy pink glow was weirdly insistent, beating at his eyes and pulling at his mind. But Alain stuffed it resolutely into the drawstring bag again without looking at it, and as he pulled the cord, yanking the bag's mouth shut, he saw the pink light wink out, as if it knew it had lost, for the time being at least. He turned back and winced at the sight of the bruise puffing up from the middle of Roland's brow. "Is he out cold?" Cuthbert said. "You better come too soon." Cuthbert looked at him grimly, with not a trace of his usual amiability. "Yes," he said. "You're certainly right about that." Seven. Shimi waited at the foot of the stairs which led down to the kitchen area, shifting uneasily from foot to foot and waiting for Cy Thorin to come back or to call him. He didn't know how long she'd been in the kitchen, but it felt like forever. He wanted her to come back. And more than that, more than anything, he wanted her to bring Susan Cy with her. Shimi had a terrible feeling about this place and this day, a feeling that darkened like the sky, which was now all obscured with smoke in the west. What was happening out there, or if it had anything to do with the thundery sounds he'd heard earlier, Shimi didn't know. But he wanted to be out of here before the smoke-hazed sun went down and the real demon moon, not its pallid day-ghost, rose in the sky. One of the swinging doors between the corridor and the kitchen pushed open, and Olive came hurrying out. She was alone. "She's in the pantry, all right," Olive said. She raked her fingers through her graying hair. "I got that much out of those two pupuras, but no more. I knew it was going to be that way as soon as they started talking that stupid crunk of theirs." There was no proper word for the dialect of the Magus Vaqueros, but crunk served well enough among the barony's higher-born citizens. Olive knew both of the Vaqs guarding the pantry, in the vague way of a person who has once ridden a lot and passed gossip and weather with other drop riders, and she knew damned well these old boys could do better than Crunk. They had spoken it so they could pretend to misunderstand her, and save both them and her the embarrassment of an outright refusal. She had gone along with the deception for much the same reason, although she could have responded with Crunk of her own perfectly well— and called them some names their mothers never used had she wanted.
I told them there were men upstairs, she said, and I thought maybe they meant to steal the silver. I said I wanted the maleficios turned out, and still they played dumb. No habla, Sai. Shit. Shit.
Shimi thought of calling them a couple of big old son-of-a-bitches and decided to keep silent. She was pacing back and forth in front of him and throwing an occasional burning look at the closed kitchen doors. At last she stopped in front of Shimi again.
"Turn out your pockets," she said. "Let's see what you have for hopes and garlands."
Shimi did as she asked, producing a little pocket knife, a gift from Stanley Ruiz, and a half-eaten cookie from one. From the other, he brought out 3 ladyfinger firecrackers, a Big Banger, and a few sulfur matches. Olive's eyes gleamed when she saw these.
"Listen to me, Shimi," she said.
8. Cuthbert patted Roland's face with no result. Alain pushed him aside, knelt, and took the gunslinger's hands. He had never used the touch this way, but had been told it was possible, that one could reach another's mind, at least in some cases.
"Roland! Roland, wake up! Please, we need you!"
At first there was nothing. Then Roland stirred, muttered, and pulled his hands out of a lens. In the moment before his eyes opened, both of the other 2 boys were struck by the same fear of what they might see. No eyes at all, only raving pink light. But they were Roland's eyes, all right, those cool blue shooter's eyes. He struggled to gain his feet and failed the first time. He held out his hands. Cuthbert took one, Alain the other. As they pulled him up, Bert saw a strange and frightening thing. There were threads of white in Roland's hair. There had been none that morning. He would have sworn to it. The morning had been a long time ago, however. "How long was I out?" Roland touched the bruise in the center of his forehead with the tips of his fingers and winced.
"Not long," Alain said. 5 minutes, maybe. "Roland, I'm sorry I hit you, but I had to. It was... I thought it was killing you."
"Mayhap 'twas. Is it safe?"
Alain pointed wordlessly to the drawstring bag.
"Good. It's best one of you carry it for now. I might be..."
He searched for the right word, and when he found it, a small, wintry smile touched the corners of his mouth.
"Tempted," he finished. "Let's ride for Hanging Rock. We've got work yet to finish."
"Roland,"
Cuthbert began. Roland turned, one hand on the horn of his horse's saddle. Cuthbert licked his lips, and for a moment Alain didn't think he would be able to ask.
"If you don't, I will," Alain thought.
But Bert managed, bringing the words out in a rush.
"What did you see?"
"Much," Roland said. "I saw much. But most of it is already fading out of my mind, the way dreams do when you wake up. What I do remember, I'll tell you as we ride. You must know, because it changes everything. We're going back to Gilead, but not for long."
"Where after that?"
Alain asked, mounting. "West, in search of the Dark Tower. If we survive today, that is. Come on, let's take those tankers."
9.
The 2 vacs were rolling smokes when there was a loud bang from upstairs. They both jumped and looked at each other, the tobacco from their works in progress sifting down to the floor in small brown flurries. A woman shrieked. The doors burst open. It was the mayor's widow again, this time accompanied by a maid. The vacs knew her well, Maria Tomas, the daughter of an old compadre from the piano ranch.
"The thieving bastards have set the place on fire," Maria cried, speaking to them in crunk. "Come and help!"
"Maria, Sai, we have orders to guard. A putina locked in the pantry?"
Maria shouted, her eyes blazing.
"Come, you stupid old donkey, before the whole place catches. Then you can explain to Signor Lengel why you stood here using your thumbs for fart corks while Seafront burned down around your ears."
"Go on," Olive snapped. "Are you cowards?"
There were several smaller bangs, as above them in the great parlor Shimi set off the ladyfingers. He used the same match to light the drapes. The two viejos exchanged a glance. "Andale," said the older of the two, then looked back at Maria. He no longer bothered with the crunk. "Watch this door," he said.
"Like a hawk,"
she agreed. The two old men bustled out, one gripping the cords of his bolas, the other pulling a long knife from the scabbard on his belt. As soon as the women heard their footsteps on the stairs at the end of the hall, Olive nodded to Maria, and they crossed the room. Maria threw the bolts. Olive pulled the door open. Susan came out at once, looking from one to the other, then smiling tentatively. Maria gasped at the sight of her mistress's swelled face and the blood crusted around her nose. Susan took Maria's hand before the maid could touch her face and squeezed her fingers gently.
"Do you think Thorin would want me now?"
she asked, and then seemed to realize who her other rescuer was.
"Olive! Sigh, Thorin, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be cruel. But you must believe that Roland, him ye know as Will Dearborn, would never—"
"I know it well," Olive said. "And there's no time for this now. Come on."
She and Maria led Susan out of the kitchen, away from the stairs ascending to the main house, and toward the storage rooms at the far north end of the lower level. In the dry goods storage room, Olive told the two of them to wait. She was gone for perhaps 5 minutes, but to Susan and Maria it seemed an eternity. When she came back, Olive was wearing a wildly colored serape much too big for her. It might have been her husband's, but Susan thought it looked too big for the late mayor as well. Olive had tucked a piece of it into the side of her jeans to keep from stumbling over it. Slung over her arm, like blankets, she had two more, both smaller and lighter.
"Put these on," she said. "It's going to be cold."
Leaving the dry goods store, they went down a narrow servants' passageway toward the back courtyard. There, if they were fortunate, and if Miguel was still unconscious, Shimi would be waiting for them with mounts. Olive hoped with all her heart that they would be fortunate. She wanted Susan safely away from Hambry before the sun went down. And before the moon rose. 10. "Susan's been taken prisoner," Roland told the others as they rode west toward Hanging Rock. "That's the first thing I saw in the glass." He spoke with such an air of absence that Cuthbert almost reined up. This wasn't the ardent lover of the last few months. It was as if Roland had found a dream to ride through the pink air within the ball, and part of him rode it still. "Or is it riding him?" Cuthbert wondered.
"What?"
Alain asked.
"Susan taken? How? By whom? Is she all right?"
"Taken by Jonas. He hurt her some, but not too badly. She'll heal. And she'll live. I'd turn around in a second if I thought her life was in any real danger." Ahead of them, appearing and disappearing in the dust like a mirage, was Hanging Rock. Cuthbert could see the sunlight pricking hazy sun stars on the tankers, and he could see men, a lot of them, a lot of horses as well. He patted the neck of his own mount, then glanced across to make sure Alain had Lengil's machine gun. He did. Cuthbert reached around to the small of his back, making sure of the slingshot. It was there. Also his deerskin ammunition bag, which now contained a number of the big bangers Shimi had stolen, as well as steel shot.
"He's using every ounce of his will to keep from going back anyway," Cuthbert thought.
He found the realization comforting. Sometimes Roland scared him. There was something in him that went beyond steel, something like madness. If it was there, you were glad to have it on your side, but often you wished it wasn't there at all, on anybody's side.
"Where is she?" Alain asked.
"Reynolds took her back to Seafront. She's locked in the pantry, or was locked there. I can't say which exactly, because..." Roland paused, thinking. The ball sees far, but sometimes it sees more. Sometimes it sees a future that's already happening.
"How can the future already be happening?" Alain asked.
"I don't know. And I don't think it was always that way. I think it's more to do with the world than Merlin's rainbow. Time is strange now. We know that, don't we? How things sometimes seem to slip. It's almost as if there's a thinny everywhere, breaking things down. But Susan's safe. I know that, and that's enough for me. Shimi is going to help her, or is helping her. Somehow Jonas missed Shimi, and he followed Susan all the way back. "Good for Shimi," Alan said, and pumped his fist into the air. "Hurrah!" Then, "What about us? Did you see us in this future?" No. This part was all quick. I hardly snatched more than a glance before the ball took me away. Flew me away, it seemed. But I saw smoke on the horizon, I remember that. It could have been the smoke of burning tankers, or the brush piled in front of Eyebolt, or both. I think we're going to succeed. Cuthbert was looking at his old friend in a queerly distraught way. The young man, so deeply in love that Bert had needed to knock him into the dust of the courtyard in order to wake him up to his responsibilities. Where was that young man, exactly? What had changed him, given him those disturbing strands of white hair? "If we survive what's ahead," Cuthbert said, watching the gunslinger closely, "she'll meet us on the road. Won't she, Roland?" He saw the pain on Roland's face and now understood. The lover was here, but the ball had taken away his joy and left only grief. That, and some new purpose. Yes, Cuthbert felt it very well, which had yet to be stated. "I don't know," Roland said. "I almost hope not, because we can never be as we were." "What?" This time Cuthbert did rein up. Roland looked at him calmly enough, but now there were tears in his eyes. "We are fools of Ka," the gunslinger said. "Ka like a wind, Susan calls it." He looked first at Cuthbert on his left, then at Alen on his right. "The tower is our Ka, mine especially, but it isn't hers, nor she mine. No more is John Farson our Ka. We're not going toward his men to defeat him, but only because they're in our way." He raised his hands, then dropped them again, as if to say, "What more do you need me to tell you?" "There is no tower, Roland," Cuthbert said patiently. "I don't know what you saw in that glass ball, but there is no tower. Well, as a symbol, I suppose, like Arthur's cup or the cross of the man Jesus, but not as a real thing, a real building, yes," Roland said. "It's real." They looked at him uncertainly and saw no doubt on his face. "It's real, and our fathers know. Beyond the dark land, I can't remember its name now, it's one of the things I've lost, is Endworld. And in Endworld stands the Dark Tower. Its existence is the great secret our fathers keep. It's what has held them together as Ka-Tet across all the years of the world's decline. When we return to Gilead, if we return, and I now think we will, I'll tell them what I've seen, and they'll confirm what I say." "You saw all that in the glass?" Alan asked in an awe-hushed voice. "I saw much."
"But not Susan Delgado," Cuthbert said.
"No. When we finish with yonder men and she finishes with Magus, her part in our Ka-Tet ends." Inside the ball I was given a choice. Susan, and my life as her husband and father of the child she now carries, or the tower. Roland wiped his face with a shaking hand. "I would choose Susan in an instant, if not for one thing. The tower is crumbling, and if it falls, everything we know will be swept away. There will be chaos beyond our imagining. We must go, and we will go." Above his young and unlined cheeks, below his young and unlined brow, were the ancient killer's eyes that Eddie Dean would first glimpse in the mirror of an airliner's bathroom. But now they swam with childish tears. There was nothing childish in his voice, however. "I choose the tower. I must. Let her live a good life and long with someone else. She will in time. As for me, I choose the tower."
11. Susan mounted on pylon, which Shimi had hastened to bring around to the rear courtyard after lighting the draperies of the great parlor on fire. Olive Thorin rode one of the barony geldings, with Shimi double-mounted behind her and holding on to Cappy's lead. Maria opened the back gate, wished them good luck, and the three trotted out. The sun was westering now, but the wind had pulled away most of the smoke that had risen earlier. Whatever had happened in the desert, it was over now. Or happening on some other layer of the same present time.
"Roland, be thee well," Susan thought. "I'll see thee soon, dear, as soon as I can."
"Why are we going north?" she asked, after half an hour's silent riding.
"Because Seacoast Road's best. But hush! They'll find you gone and search the house first, if 'tasn't burned flat, that is. Not finding you there, they'll send west along the Great Road."
She cast an eye on Susan that was not much like the dithery, slightly confabulated Olive Thorin that folks in Henry knew, or thought they knew.
"If I know that's the direction you'd choose, so will others we'd do well to avoid."
Susan was silent. She was too confused to speak, but Olive seemed to know what she was about, and Susan was grateful for that.
"By the time they get around to sniffing west, it'll be dark. Tonight we'll stay in one of the sea cliff caves 5 miles or so from here. I grew up a fisherman's daughter, and I know all those caves, none better."
The thought of the cave she'd played in as a girl seemed to cheer her.
"Tomorrow we'll cut west, as you like. I'm afraid you're going to have a plump old widow as a chaperone for a bit. Better get used to the idea."
"Thee's too good," Susan said.
"You should send Shimi and I on alone, Si."
"And go back to what? Why, I can't even get 2 old trail hands on kitchen duty to follow my orders. Fran Langill's boss of the shooting match now, and I've no urge to wait and see how he does at it. Nor if he decides he'd be better off with me adjudged mad and put up safe in a hussy with bars on the windows. Or shall I stay to see how Hash Renfrew does as mayor, with his boots up on my tables?"
Olive actually laughed.
"Si, I'm sorry."
"We shall all be sorry later on," Olive said, sounding remarkably cheery about it.
"For now the most important thing is to reach those caves unobserved. It must seem that we vanished into thin air. Hold up."
Olive checked her horse, stood in the stirrups, looked around to make sure of her position, nodded, then twisted in the saddle so she could speak to Shimi.
"Young man, it's time for you to mount your trusty mule and go back to Seafront. If there are riders coming after us, you must turn them aside with a few well-chosen words. Will he do that?"
Shimi looked stricken.
"I don't have any well-chosen words, Si Thorin, so I don't. I hardly have any words at all."
"Nonsense," Olive said, and kissed Shimi's forehead. "Go back at a goodish trot. If you spy no one coming after us by the time the sun touches the hills, then turn north again and follow. We shall wait for you by the signpost. Do you know where I mean?"
Shimi thought he did, although it marked the outmost northern boundary of his little patch of geography.
"The red'un, with the sombrero on it, and the arrow pointing back for town?"
"The very one. You won't get that far until after dark, but there'll be plenty of moonlight tonight. If you don't come right away, we'll wait. But you must go back and shift any men that might be chasing us off our track. Do you understand?"
Shimi did. He slid off Olive's horse, clucked Capricoso forward, and climbed on board, wincing as the place the mule had bitten came down.
"So it'll be, Olive Si."
"Good, Shimi, good. Off you go, then." "Shimi," Susan said, "come to me a moment, please."
He did, holding his hat in front of him and looking up at her worshipfully. Susan bent and kissed him, not on the forehead, but firmly on the mouth. Shimi came close to fainting.
"Thank ye, Si," Susan said, "for everything."
Shimi nodded. When he spoke, he could manage nothing above a whisper.
"'Twas only Kaa," he said. "I know that. But I love you, Susan Si. Go well. I'll see you soon.
I look forward to it."
But there was no soon, and no later for them either.
Shimi took one look back as he rode his mule south and waved. Susan lifted her own hand in return. It was the last Shimi ever saw of her, and in many ways, that was a blessing. 12. The Tego had set pickets a mile out from Hanging Rock, but the blonde boy Roland, Cuthbert, and Alain encountered as they closed in on the tankers looked confused and unsure of himself, no danger to anyone. He had scurvy blossoms around his mouth and nose, suggesting that the men Farson had sent on this duty had ridden hard and fast, with little in the way of fresh supplies. When Cuthbert gave the good man Segul, hands clasped to the chest, left above right, then both held out to the person being greeted, the blonde picket did the same, and with a grateful smile.
"What's spinning rarey back there?"
he asked, speaking with a strong in-world accent. To Roland, the boy sounded like a Nordite.
"Three boys who killed a couple of big bugs and then hide for the hills," Cuthbert replied. He was an eerily good mimic, and gave the boy back his own accent faultlessly. "There were a fight. It be over now, but they did fight fearful."
"What no time," Roland said brusquely. "We have dispatches." He crossed his hands on his chest, then held them out. "Heil, Farson."
"Good man,"
the blonde returned smartly. He gave back the salute with a smile that said he would have asked Cuthbert where he was from and who he was related to if there had been more time. Then they were past him and inside Letigo's perimeter, as easy as that. "Remember that it's hit and run," Roland said. "Slow down for nothing. What we don't get must be left. There'll be no second pass."
"Gods, don't even suggest such a thing," Cuthbert said.
But he was smiling. He pulled his sling out of its rudimentary holster and tested its elastic draw with a thumb. Then he licked the thumb and hoisted it to the wind. Not much problem there, if they came in as they were. The wind was strong, but at their backs." Alain unslung Langill's machine gun, looked at it doubtfully, then yanked back the slide cock.
"I don't know about this, Roland. It's loaded, and I think I see how to use it, but then use it," Roland said.
The three of them were picking up speed now, the hooves of their horses drumming against the hard pan. The wind gusted, belling the fronts of their serapes. "This is the sort of work it was meant for. If it jams, drop it and use your revolver. Are you ready?"
"Yes, Roland."
"Bert?"
"Aye," Cuthbert said in a wildly exaggerated Hambry accent.
"So I am, so I am."
Ahead of them, dust puffed as groups of riders passed before and behind the tankers, readying the column for departure. Men on foot looked around at the oncomers curiously, but with a fatal lack of alarm. Roland drew both revolvers.
"Gilead!" he cried. "Heil, Gilead!"
He spurred Rusher to a gallop. The other two boys did the same. Cuthbert was in the middle again, sitting on his reins, slingshot in hand, lucifer matches radiating out of his tightly pressed lips. The gunslingers rode down on Hanging Rock like furies. 13. 20 minutes after sending Shimi back south, Susan and Olive came around a sharp bend and found themselves face to face with three mounted men in the road. In the late slanting sun, she saw that the one in the middle had a blue coffin tattooed on his hand. It was Reynolds. Susan's heart sank. The one on Reynolds's left, he wore a stained white drover's hat and had a lazily cocked eye, she didn't know, but the one on the right, who looked like a stony-hearted preacher, was Laszlo Reimer. It was Reimer that Reynolds glanced at after smiling at Susan.
"Why, Laz and I couldn't even get us a drink to send his late brother, the Chancellor of whatever you want and the Minister of Thank You Very Much, on with a word," Reynolds said. "We hadn't hardly hit town before we got persuaded out here. I wasn't going to go, but damn, that old lady's something. Could talk a corpse into giving a blowjob, if you'll pardon the crudity."
"I think your aunt may have lost a wheel or two off her cart, though," sighed Delgado. "Your friends are dead," Susan told him.
Reynolds paused, shrugged.
"Well, now, maybe see and maybe no. Me, I think I've decided to travel on without 'em even if they ain't. But I might hang around here one more night. This reaping business, I've heard so much about the way folks do it in the Otters. Especially the bonfire part.
The man with the cocked eye laughed phlegmily.
"Let us pass," Olive said. "This girl has done nothing, and neither have I."
"She helped Dearborn escape," Reimer said. "Him who murdered your own husband and my brother. I wouldn't call that nothing."
"The gods may restore Kimber Reimer in the clearing," Olive said, "but the truth is he looted half of this town's treasury, and what he didn't give over to John Fawson he kept for himself."
Reimer recoiled as if slapped.
"You didn't know I knew. Laszlo, I'd be angry at how little any of you thought of me, except why would I want to be thought of by the likes of you anyway? I knew enough to make me sick. Leave it at that. I know that the man you're sitting beside—"
"Shut up," Reimer muttered,
"was likely the one who cut your brother's black heart open. Cy Reynolds was seen that early morning in that wing, so I've been told—"
"Shut up, you cunt!"
"And so I believe."
"Better do as he says, Cy, and hold your tongue," Reynolds said.
Some of the lazy good humor had left his face, Susan thought.
He doesn't like people knowing what he did, not even when he's the one on top and what they know can't hurt him. And he's less without Jonas, a lot less. He knows it, too.
"Let us pass," Olive said.
"No, Si, I can't do that."
"I'll help you then, shall I?"
Her hand had crept beneath the outrageously large serape during the palaver, and now she brought out a huge and ancient pistola, its handles of yellowed ivory, its filigreed barrel of old tarnished silver. On top was a brass powder and spark. Olive had no business even drawing the thing. It caught on her serape, and she had to fight it free. She had no business cocking it either, a process that took both thumbs and two tries. But the three men were utterly flummoxed by the sight of the elderly blunderbuss in her hands, Reynolds as much as the other two. He sat his horse with his jaw hanging slack. Jonas would have wept.
"Get her!"
a cracked old voice shrieked from behind the men blocking the road.
"What's wrong with you, you stupid culls? Get her!"
Reynolds started at that and went for his gun. He was fast, but he had given Olive too much of a head start and was beaten, beaten cold. Even as he cleared leather with the barrel of his revolver, the mayor's widow held the old gun out in both hands and, squinching her eyes shut like a little girl who is forced to eat something nasty, pulled the trigger. The spark flashed, but the damp powder only made a weary floop sound and disappeared in a puff of blue smoke. The ball, big enough to have taken Clay Reynolds's head off from the nose on up had it fired, stayed in the barrel. In the next instant his own gun roared in his fist. Olive's horse reared, whinnying. Olive went off the gelding head over boots with a black hole in the orange stripe of her serape, the stripe which lay above her heart. Susan heard herself screaming. The sound seemed to come from very far away. She might have gone on for some time, but then she heard the clop of approaching pony hooves from behind the men in the road, and knew, even before the man with the lazy eye moved aside to show her, she knew, and her screams stopped. The galloped-out pony that had brought the witch back to Hambry had been replaced by a fresh one. But it was the same black cart, the same golden cabalistic symbols, the same driver. Rhea sat with the reins in her claws, her head ticking from side to side like the head of a rusty old robot, grinning at Susan without humor, grinning as a corpse grins.
"Hello, my little sweeting," she said, calling her as she had all those months ago, on the night Susan had come to her hut to be proved honest, on the night Susan had come running most of the way out of simple high spirits. Beneath the light of the kissing moon she had come, her blood high from the exercise, her skin flushed. She had been singing careless love.
"Your pallies and screw buddies have taken my ball, you can," Rhea said, clucking the pony to a stop a few paces ahead of the riders. Even Reynolds looked down on her with uneasiness. "Took my lovely glam. That's what those bad boys did. Those bad, bad boys. But it showed me much while yet I had it, aye. It sees far, and in more ways than one. Much of it I forgot. but not which way he'd come, my sweeting. Not which way that precious old dead bitch laying yonder on the road would bring ye. And now ye must go to town."
Her grin widened, became something unspeakable.
"It's time for the fair, ye ken."
"Let me go," Susan said. "Let me go if ye had not answer to Roland of Gilead."
Rhea ignored her and spoke to Reynolds.
"Bind her hands before her and stand her in the back of the cart. There's people that want to see her. A good look is what they want, and a good look is just what they'll have. If her aunt's done a proper job, there'll be a lot of them in town. Get her up now and be smart about it."
14. Alain had time for one clear thought. We could have gone around them. If what Roland said is true, then only the wizard's glass matters, and we have that. We could have gone around them. Except, of course, that was impossible. 100 generations of gunslinger blood argued against it. Tower or no tower, the thieves must not be allowed to have their prize, not if they could be stopped. Alain leaned forward and spoke directly into his horse's ear. "Jig or rear when I start shooting and I'll knock your fucking brains out." Roland led them in, outracing the other two on his stronger horse. The clot of men nearest by, 5 or 6 mounted, 12 or more on foot, and examining a pair of the oxen which had dragged the tankers out here, gazed at him stupidly until he began to fire, and then they scattered like quail. He got every one of the riders. Their horses fled in a widening fan, trailing their reins, and in one case a dead soldier. Somewhere someone was shouting, "Harriers! Harriers! Mount up, you fools!" "Alain!" Roland screamed as they bore down. In front of the tankers, a double handful of riders and armed men were coming together, milling together in a clumsy defensive line. "Now! Now!" Alain raised the machine gun, seated its rusty wire stock in the hollow of his shoulder, and remembered what little he knew about rapid-fire weapons. Aim low, swing fast and smooth. He touched the trigger, and the speed shooter bellowed into the dusty air, recoiling against his shoulder in a series of rapid thuds, shooting bright fire from the end of its perforated barrel. Alain raked it from left to right, running the sight above the scattering, shouting defenders and across the high steel hides of the tankers. The third tanker actually blew up on its own. The sound it made was like no explosion Alain had ever heard, a guttural, muscular, ripping sound accompanied by a brilliant flash of orange-red fire. The steel shell rose in 2 halves. One of these spun 30 yards through the air and landed on the desert floor in a furiously burning hulk. The other rose straight up into a column of greasy black smoke. A burning wooden wheel spun across the sky like a plate and came back down trailing sparks and burning splinters. Men fled, screaming, some on foot, others laid flat along the necks of their nags, their eyes wide and panicky. When Alain reached the end of the line of tankers, he reversed the track of the muzzle. The machine gun was hot in his hands now, but he kept his finger pressed to the trigger. In this world, you had to use what you could while it still worked. Beneath him, his horse ran on, as if it had understood every word Alain had whispered in its ear. "Another! I want another!" But before he could blow another tanker, the gun ceased its chatter, perhaps jammed, probably empty. Alain threw it aside and drew his revolver. From beside him there came the thump of Cuthbert's slingshot, audible even over the cries of the men, the hoofbeats of the horses, the whoosh of the burning tanker. Alain saw a sputtering big bang arc into the sky and come down exactly where Cuthbert had aimed, in the oil puddling around the wooden wheels of a tanker marked Sunoco. For a moment, Alain could clearly see the line of 9 or 12 holes in the tanker's bright side, holes he had put there with Cy Lengel's speed shooter. And then there was a crack and a flash as the big bang exploded. A moment later, the holes running along the bright flank of the tanker began to shimmer. The oil beneath them was on fire.
"Get out!" a man in a faded campaign hat yelled. "She's going to blow! They're all going to blow!"
Alain shot him, exploding the side of his face and knocking him out of one old sprung boot. A moment later, the second tanker blew up. One burning steel panel shot out sideways, landed in the growing puddle of crude oil beneath a third tanker, and then that one exploded as well. Black smoke rose in the air like the fumes of a funeral pyre. It darkened the day and drew an oily veil across the sun. All six of Farson's chief lieutenants had been carefully described to Roland, to all 14 gunslingers in training, and he recognized the man running for the Remuda at once, George Letigo. Roland could have shot him as he ran, but that, ironically, would have made possible a getaway that was cleaner than he wanted. Instead, he shot the man who ran to meet him. Letigo wheeled on the heels of his boots and stared at Roland with blazing, hate-filled eyes. Then he ran again, hailing another man, shouting for the riders who were huddled together beyond the burning zone. Two more tankers exploded, whamming at Roland's eardrums with dull iron fists, seeming to suck the air back from his lungs like a riptide. The plan had been for Alain to perforate the tankers and for Cuthbert to then shoot in a steady, arcing stream of Big Bangers, lighting the spilling oil. The one Big Banger he actually shot seemed to confirm that the plan had been feasible, but it was the last slingshot work Cuthbert did that day. The ease with which the gunslingers had gotten inside the enemy's perimeter and the confusion which greeted their original charge could have been chalked up to inexperience and exhaustion, but the placing of the tankers had been Letigo's mistake, and his alone. He had drawn them tight without even thinking about it, and now they blew tight, one after another. Once the conflagration began, there was no chance of stopping it. Even before Roland raised his left arm and circled it in the air, signaling for Alain and Cuthbert to break off, the work was done. Letigo's encampment was an oily inferno, and John Farson's plans for a motorized assault were so much black smoke being tattered apart by the fin de año wind.
"Ride!" Roland screamed. "Ride, ride, ride!"
They spurred west, toward Eyebolt Canyon. As they went, Roland felt a single bullet drone past his left ear. It was, so far as he knew, the only shot fired at any of them during the assault on the tankers. 16. Letigo was in an ecstasy of fury, a perfect brain-bursting rage, and that was probably merciful. It kept him from thinking of what the good man would do when he learned of this fiasco. For the time being, all Letigo cared about was catching the men who had ambushed him, if an ambush in desert country was even possible. Men? No. The boys who had done this. Letigo knew who they were, all right. He didn't know how they had gotten out here, but he knew who they were, and their run would stop right here, east of the woods and rising hills.
"Hendricks!" he bawled.
Hendricks had at least managed to hold his men, half a dozen of them, all mounted near the Remuda.
"Hendricks, to me!"
As Hendricks rode toward him, Letigo spun the other way and saw a huddle of men standing and watching the burning tankers. Their gaping mouths and stupid young sheep faces made him feel like screaming and dancing up and down, but he refused to give in to that. He held a narrow beam of concentration, one aimed directly at the raiders, who must not, under any circumstances, be allowed to escape.
"You!"
he shouted at the men. One of them turned. The others did not. Letigo strode to them, drawing his pistol as he went. He slapped it into the hand of the man who had turned toward the sound of his voice and pointed at random to one of those who had not.
"Shoot that fool!"
Dazed, his face that of a man who believes he is dreaming, the soldier raised the pistol and shot the man to whom Letigo had pointed. That unlucky fellow went down in a heap of knees and elbows and twitching hands. The others turned.
"Good," Letigo said, taking his gun back.
"Sir," Hendricks cried. "I see them, sir. I have the enemy in clear view." Two more tankers exploded. A few wickering shards of steel flew in their direction. Some of the men ducked. Letigo did not so much as twitch, nor did Hendricks.
A good man. Thank God for at least one such in this nightmare. Shall I hie after them, sir? I'll take your men and hie after them myself, Hendricks. Mount those hoss guts before us. He swept an arm at the standing men, whose doltish attention had been diverted from the burning tankers to their dead comrade. Pull in as many others as you can. Do you have a bugler? Yes, sir. Rain, sir. Hendricks looked around, beckoned, and a pimply, scared-looking boy rode forward, a dented bugle on a frayed strap hung askew on the front of his shirt. "Rains," Letigo said, "you're with Hendricks." "Yes, sir." "Get as many men as you can, Hendricks, but don't linger over the job. They're headed for that canyon, and I believe someone told me it's a box. If so, we're going to turn it into a shooting gallery." Hendricks's lips spread in a twisted grin. "Yes, sir." Behind them, the tankers continued to explode. 17. Roland glanced back and was astonished by the size of the black, smoky column rising into the air. Ahead, he could clearly see the brush blocking most of the canyon's mouth. And although the wind was blowing the wrong way, he could now hear the maddening mosquito whine of the thinny. He patted the air with his outstretched hands, signaling for Cuthbert and Alain to slow down. While they were both still looking at him, he took off his bandana, whipped it into a rope, and tied it so it would cover his ears. They copied him. It was better than nothing. The gunslingers continued west, their shadows now running out behind them as long as gantries on the desert floor. Looking back, Roland could see two groups of riders streaming in pursuit. Letigo was at the head of the first, Roland thought, and he was deliberately holding his riders back a little so that the two groups could merge and attack together. Good, he thought. The three of them rode toward Eyebolt in a tight line, continuing to hold